Welcome to Scope It Out. In this episode, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Greg Davis, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology and Director of Rhinology and Endoscopic Skull-Based Surgery at the University of Washington. They will discuss the article, Manuka Honey Sinus Irrigation for the Treatment of Chronic Rhinosinusitis, a Randomized Controlled Trial.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast for the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm Dr. Tim Smith, your host, and today I'm joined by Dr. Greg Davis, who is at the University of Washington in Seattle, just north of me here in Portland, Oregon. Greg, how are you?
Tim, I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me onto your podcast. I've enjoyed listening to them over the last several months.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm really happy to have you on. We're going to talk about your article, which is now available in Early View in IFAR. It's entitled Manuka Honey Sinus Irrigation for the Treatment of Chronic Rhinosinusitis, and it's a randomized controlled trial. Maybe start out, just tell us, why did you decide to study Manuka Honey? Give us the background on that.
Manuka Honey, it has been around for a very long time, and when I was down in Adelaide spending a bit of time with PJ Wormald, he was talking about Manuka Honey, and he had this sheep model, and they would use Manuka honey and watch how it affected the microbiome, the Staph aureus and Pseudomonas of these chronic sinus models, and that was pretty interesting. And then I came back to Seattle and was talking with another friend, Amin Aver, up in Vancouver, and he really liked Manuka honey and has done some work with it. So I was using it on these patients where I would do surgery, and the sinuses would stay open, but the sinuses would just be filled of thick mucopurulent material. And we had tried several different compounds and antibiotics and just weren't quite making the response we wanted. So we thought about doing Manuka honey, and really at this point thought it needed to be done as a randomized trial.
Yeah. So anecdotally, did you notice the Manuka honey was helping when you just tried it in those patients?
You know, many patients really liked it. And a classic comment, they would come back and say, it just made it feel like the mucus just slipped out easier. That was overwhelmingly what people would say. But then again, there were many people who would come back and say, you know, I tried it. It tasted kind of good, but it really didn't seem to do anything.
I guess it would taste good. It should taste good. Is Manuka honey, I mean, is that a specific bee or is it a region, or why is it called Manuka?
So there is a region of Manuka. It's over in New Zealand, and it's a specific area. There's a lot of tea trees in this region. It's in the Manuka region of New Zealand. They make Manuka honey. It's just good old regular honey from this particular region.
Are they like pollinating on a certain plant, or would a bees go to flower or something like that?
Well, it again, it's mainly this tea tree. We've all heard of tea tree oil. It's the tree that makes tea tree oil, and that's the most common, evidently the most common plant that the bees pollinate on, whether or not that transfers any of these properties. But it was found that Manuka honey in particular has this higher concentration of MGO, or this methyl glyoxal, which is thought to be the active ingredient in honey, as opposed to clover honey, or what you and I may buy at the market, that has a much lower concentration of MGO.
Have you tasted this stuff before? I mean, yeah. I'm just wondering, would I be able to distinguish it from the honey that we eat?
Yeah, it's definitely not that great. I would not put it on my toast. You know, it's better than nothing, but it's not as good as the regular clover honey or table honey. It's a little bit more acidic as well. Kind of has a bitter taste to it.
Okay. And then this is medical grade honey we're talking about. So it goes through some kind of processing, and it goes through some kind of quality management processes. Just to be clear to our listeners, you're just not taking some honey from some region and doing this. You're buying this medical grade. And in fact, I read in your paper that if you were going to treat someone with this, it could cost on the order of $200 a month to irrigate Manuka honey at the concentrations you used.
Yeah, that's correct. So when we were thinking about doing this study, myself and at the time one of my research residents, Dr. Victoria Lee, she's one of our otolaryngology residents who happens to be applying for rhinology fellowships this year, but she and I looked at many, many different types of Manuka honey out there on the market, and you can go to your grocery store and buy it. We found out, though, was that our hospital actually uses this medicine-grade Manuka honey called MediHoney, and we spoke to our wound care nurses and the burn treatment center where they use this, and it turns out there's a company that makes this. And what makes it unique from the other honeys on the market is that it is gamma-radiated. So we know that it's much less chance to have any contaminants or spores that could be present. And then there is quality control with how they batch it and how it's processed and sterilized. So that's what makes it the medicine-grade Manuka honey. It is still not considered a medication, though. So that's an important distinction. It's considered just essentially a cosmetic, something that can be applied without a prescription.
So let's talk about your study design a little bit. It's a randomized controlled trial, and you randomized patients with chronic sinusitis who had had prior surgery. So these are all post-operative patients. And they were randomized to either a 10% Manuka honey irrigation or a saline irrigation. And these were high-volume irrigations, whether it was Manuka honey or the saline alone. Is that any other highlights we should mention there?
No, that's it. We are building off of the really well-done research recently that shows to get any medicine or compound into the operated sinuses, you need to add it to large-volume irrigation, where we've gone away from the sprays and nebulizers and have replaced it with this. So that's true. And then the concentration, we spent a lot of time working on the concentration, and 10% is, it's in the range of bactericidal, so it will kill the bugs. At the same time, it's tolerable. And if you have too much of a concentration, it really starts to become a bit irritating when you irrigate with it. But at 10%, most people tolerate it very well.
So interestingly, despite your randomization, there were some baseline differences between the two groups. Let's see, the CT severity score was higher in the saline group,
right?
11 versus 8 in the Manuka honey group. That's a Lund-Mackay CT score. And then asthma was more prevalent in the saline group as compared to the Manuka honey group. So I guess you'd say that somehow, even with randomization, perhaps there's a slightly higher severity group in the saline group as compared to the Manuka honey group. Or how would you comment on that?
I agree. So that's the challenge with small randomized studies, is there can be a breakdown of randomization. Even though people were divided by protocol, if you have a small enough population, there can be a skew of one population or one comorbidity in one group and not in the other. That's why we do the analysis to see if randomization was successful on these major comorbidities. And if not, you can go on and do a adjusted analysis. And we did that as part. It did not change the end results, but it is important to point out, and I agree with you, that the saline group was a little bit more severe in their disease compared to, at least on CT scan and the asthma, as opposed to the Manuka honey. Now, all other factors of presence of polyps, aspirin sensitivity, smokers, were equal between the two groups.
Okay. And they irrigated twice a day for 30 days, and then you measured several outcomes. The one I was most interested in, of course, was the quality of life, this not 22, where you found a clinically relevant improvement in both groups, about minus 12 points on the SNOT 22 in each of the two groups. And just for our listeners, somewhere around 9 or 10 is, let's just say 10. If you have a 10-point change, that's considered a clinically significant improvement on the SNOT 22. So both of these groups had about 12. Fair to say? Anything to comment on there, Greg?
Well, this is, in our opinion, the most important outcome measure. Our primary outcome measure was the SNOT 22. This patient-reported outcome measure is key, and that's really what counts. How does the patient feel? Both groups did better. But both groups received treatment, and we'll talk about that shortly. The difference between the two was negligible. Essentially, this was a negative study showing that the Manuka honey, as opposed to the saline, really didn't change their patient-reported symptoms. One of the challenges that I'm sure you're just about ready to ask me, Tim, is, well, what other treatments did they get during the study? That's one of the challenges with a topical randomized trial like this where we did not exclude other treatments. So some of these patients were on oral antibiotics, some were on oral steroids, and that probably made an impact in the difference, at least in finding a negative study.
Now, a couple of the outcomes that you measured were not negative. Let's see, the endoscopic score in the Manuka honey group improved to a greater degree than in the saline group. And then you performed cultures post-treatment, and you found that the Manuka honey group, they were more likely to have culture, you called it culture negativity. So I guess you didn't grow staph or pseudomonas in that particular patient population. Or maybe it was culture negativity across the board.
That's right. So in the Manuka honey group, the culture negativity. So what we did at the beginning of the study, we took an endoscopic collected culture. A month later, after a month of irrigations with Manuka honey or saline, they came back to clinic and we took another culture. If the same pathogen grew out, that was positive. If it didn't grow out, that was negative. So there was a more likely chance that in the Manuka honey group, they would not get that pathogen growing out. So in essence, it was cleaner. Now, the challenge was it did not meet statistical significance. And that's true for the Lund Kennedy endoscopy score as well. That improvement was quite small between Manuka honey and saline. It was only a 2-point difference, and again, was not statistically significant.
Okay. Now, you talked about concurrent treatment. I mean, some of the patients had exacerbations in the course of this month, and therefore they got antibiotics and oral steroids. Did you find that was done more commonly in the Manuka honey group versus the saline group?
So the opposite was true, and that's the interesting thing. When we looked at the group of patients, so there were 42 patients who finished the study. 16 of those patients did not have oral antibiotics or oral steroids. 10 of those patients were in the Manuka honey group, and 6 of those were in the saline group. So as an ad hoc, post hoc analysis, again, this is more hypothesis generating than trying to make a conclusion. But we looked at that subgroup and did a different calculation and analysis. And what was interesting is 50% culture negativity was found in the Manuka honey. So half the patient's bacteria was gone versus 0% culture negativity in the saline group. All of those patients, the pathogen was still present. So that's, again, hypothesizing that maybe Manuka honey alone can lead to some clearance of the pathogen that's present in some patients.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty interesting. So what would you tell the listeners about, I mean, should they be using Manuka honey in their practice at this time? Are you using Manuka honey in your practice at this time?
Very, very good question. So at this point, looking at this study, I would say no, that Manuka honey is an option, but the research doesn't show that using it alone will have a dramatic improvement in patient-reported outcomes. It can help decrease or improve the clearance of a pathogen. So that being said, do I use it in my practice? I do on occasion. I use it on those patients where I look in the sinus after surgery or even several years after surgery. If the sinuses are still patent, yet they're full of purulence, we're trying to generate more enthusiasm to use topical therapies, topical steroids like budesonide, topical antibiotics, and now a topical compound such as this that might help break down some of the biofilm that staph and pseudomonas make. And I think what we're going to find over time is that it's probably going to be a combination of these three different compounds, a steroid antibiotic and biofilm drug, to really help this sticky, tenacious mucus.
And then we talked about treatment costs earlier. So you have some patients. I mean, insurance does not cover this. I would assume that insurance just doesn't cover it. Am I wrong about that?
I've never tried to get insurance to cover it.
So you have some patients who are willing to pay, you know, a couple hundred dollars a month for this. They feel like they're getting enough benefit to invest that.
There's not many there that are willing to buy MediHoney. As you said, it's over $200 for a 1 month supply, and that's a huge investment for something that we don't have great evidence that it helps substantially. Now, there are other Manuka honeys out there. The concern with those, again, it's not this medicine grade or gamma radiated. Active ingredients, the MGO, can vary significantly, and so you really don't know what you're putting up your nose. Obviously, all of this is off-label. There's not even a label for it to use. So you do have to be careful about what you're advising your patients. And as with all topical medicines that are off-label, you know, discuss with your patient that there are potential for complications. We didn't have any in this study or in our previous topical antibiotic studies, but it is something to bring up.
Have you heard of or have you used, has anybody that you know of tried our good old clover honey in that little bear-shaped container you got by at the grocery store? I mean, are people resorting to that, or have you ever done that, Greg?
We thought about using, so I'll answer two questions. Have I ever used clover honey up my nose? No, I have not.
No?
I have not, but I did use the MediHoney.
That surprises me, I have to say. I mean, if I was spending this much time studying honey, I probably would have put some clover honey up my nose by this point.
Tim, I after we get off the phone call, I encourage both of us to do it. I think that would be a fun experiment. We'll see how we do. I'm sure it's going to be fine, but the Manuka honey from MediHoney is fine and tolerated it just well. We did talk about potentially doing a study looking at MediHoney versus clover honey. In that way, you could do a double-blinded study. So this study that we did was not double-blinded. I was blinded when I did the nasal endoscopy and took the culture, but obviously the patient's either squeezing out honey out of a tube or they're just using the saline packet. So the lack of patient blinding, subject blinding, certainly can play an impact.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea, actually, to design a next study. What do you think? Are you planning a next study, or what is the next study?
I am planning a next study, but the next study is going to have a little bit different take on it. I do think the most important factor as we start to now have a couple randomized trials with topical antibiotics, steroids, and Manuka honey, there are other things out there, bacteriophage, chitosan compounds, all these things coming out. But the challenge is, a patient comes into your clinic, we want to treat them, and lots of patients expect antibiotics. Well, if we're giving them a treatment in addition to what we're trying to randomize, that's really going to confound our results. And so the next generation of topical studies really should, at least for a short duration, limit the other medications that we prescribe. And I think it's very reasonable to ask patients to withhold antibiotics for 1 or 2 weeks while you do a randomized topical trial, especially now that the international consensus guideline statements are out saying that antibiotics are an option to consider for exacerbations of chronic sinus disease.
Well, great. Well, listen, Greg, thanks a lot for joining me. It's a fascinating compound, and like you, I've been hearing about it for many years, but you're really the first to study it. It seems like in a group of patients that we all see in our clinics, I think, and we all struggle with in our clinics. And so you've advanced the evidence in that regard, and I congratulate you on that. Thanks again, and I sure look forward to having you on a podcast in the future. We can talk about the next study when that comes along.
My pleasure, Tim. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or the sponsors.